when it comes to the conflict in Gaza and the war in Ukraine, the special military operation, how do you see the contrast, anything in the war in Ukraine that the Israelis could have learned before going in Gaza?
Ukraine is is large-scale ground combat, a different kind of war. But there are some lessons, and I come at this question from this perspective. There are Russian officers who have been involved in this in the conflict from the get-go, in the conflict in Ukraine. They were involved in Mariupol, which was urban warfare. And they have taken a look at the Israeli tactics, and they've said, you guys would get slaughtered if you fought the Ukrainians. The Israeli Defense Force would be slaughtered. They'd lose everybody because their tactics are just stupid, stupid in terms of large-scale ground combat. But the Israelis aren't fighting a conventional military force. They're fighting an unconventional military force. But, you know, their tactics are stupid, not because they're the wrong tactics, they are, but because they're being executed by a military not trained properly to execute them. The IDF is very sloppy, very sloppy. The concept of security is non-existent. Hamas is able to pop up, destroy tanks, kill Israeli soldiers. You know, armor is going forward unsupported by infantry because the infantry is scared. The Israelis are not a very good military. They're competent to a degree against an enemy like Hamas. But if they fight Hezbollah, and again, an expansion of this conflict that draws in Hezbollah, Hezbollah will outclass them every way. Hezbollah has been preparing for this war. Israel's not ready for this war. Their troops are not motivated. There will be slaughtered if they go to war against Hezbollah. The only thing Israel has is an air force. Let's put it this way. If you took the Israeli air force out of the equation in Gaza, Hamas would kill every single Israeli soldier there. That's the truth. Because the Israelis just aren't that good.
Is the Netanyahu administration looking for capturing Gaza in totality?
The humanitarian pause was a defeat for Netanyahu. Remember, the Netanyahu government said there will be no ceasefire. And they aren't going to exchange prisoners for hostages. That they're there to defeat Hamas, defeat them politically, militarily. And they were unable to do that. And the implementation of the Dahiyad doctrine, this collective punishment, and you combine that with, again, we have to deal with another reality here. What Israel knew about Hamas in Gaza is no longer at play. Hamas, when they attacked on October 7th, captured the computer servers containing the Israeli intelligence about their assets inside Gaza. So Israel went blind in terms of human resources. They attacked the Unit A200 signals intelligence platforms. Israel went blind in terms of intercepting communications. So what Israel thought they knew about Gaza changed overnight. When they went in on October 7th, 8th, 9th, and thereafter, they're going in blind. They have to start all over. And how does Israel do this? Through an over-reliance of artificial intelligence. They have a targeting algorithm that they've developed where they've linked each house in Gaza to a specific outcome for Hamas. It doesn't mean that they're going to achieve it, but if you hit this house, this is what it does to Hamas. And they also know that this is how many civilian casualties will be accrued. So there is no, this is collateral damage. We had no idea so many people would die. This is deliberate murder based on target. It's called the gospel. I think the Jewish term is hasbara or something of that nature. That's in play today. This is mass murder, genocide by the Israeli government against the Palestinian people. And it failed. And so it failed on a number of fronts. It failed in regards to Hamas, but because it failed so egregiously, the Netanyahu government was under pressure from a domestic audience saying, hey, you're not succeeding. We need our relatives freed. We need the hostages released. The entire world reacted to this collective punishment, this indiscriminate bombing with horror, millions of people in the streets. The United States State Department, filed a memorandum, internal memorandum, a dissent memorandum, saying the policies of the Biden administration are destroying the credibility and viability of America abroad. And so we started putting pressure. So Netanyahu had to agree to a ceasefire. He didn't want to. This was a political disaster for him. And so he was looking for any excuse to get out of the ceasefire. He found it. They're now back at war. He can't afford to have a second ceasefire. That would be the end of him politically. But he's failing militarily. As we speak, the Netanyahu government is being, the IDF, I mean, is being defeated in certain areas of Gaza. They've had to retreat from certain areas in Gaza because of the casualties they've taken. This is hugely demoralizing for their military. So Netanyahu is and his government are in a very dire straits in terms of, you know, their domestic political reality. There's nothing they can do to change the fact that Netanyahu's political days are over. He is the problem, not the solution. He will be removed from power, either from pressure from the United States or pressure from domestic or both. But, you know, we need to stop talking about, what Israel wants right now. Israel doesn't want anything. Netanyahu wants everything. He needs to be removed and a new, more legitimate Israeli government in place that speaks on behalf of the majority of the Israeli population, then can speak about what they want. They may not change their policies. Who knows? But I think, real politics will set in and the Israelis are going to have to make adjustments. Economically, they cannot sustain this fight indefinitely with hundreds of thousands of reservists mobilized who are no longer participating in the economy, with tens of thousands of Israeli citizens displaced from not only around Gaza, but in the north, forced to be resettled, no jobs. They're living off of the support provided by the Israeli government. The economy is faltering. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli Jews are fleeing Israel for more stable locations. This is a strategic defeat, a disaster for Israel, that if they can't find the way to defeat Hamas, and I don't believe they can, you can't defeat an idea, an ideal, especially one that resonates so strongly amongst not only the Palestinian people, but the entire world. It can't be defeated by Israel. So I think the Israel won't get what it wants out of this war. We have to understand that they did not initiate this conflict. They didn't want this conflict. They weren't expecting this conflict. The Netanyahu government on October 6th had a policy that was predicated on the normalization of relations with Saudi Arabia, the initiation of this new economic-based conception that was described by Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu. Biden announced it during the G20 meeting in India, talked about the India-Middle East Economic Corridor. Benjamin Netanyahu bragged about it during his presentation to the General Assembly in the United Nations. This was the direction that Israel was going. Israel was also, under the Netanyahu government, making sure that there would never be a two-state solution, never be a Palestinian state. They were in the process of expanding operations to create new settlements in the West. And they thought that they had bought off Hamas and the Palestinians in the Gaza by increasing the number of work permits, that this perception of new economic viability on the part of the Gazan Palestinians linked to a relationship with Israel, an ongoing economic relationship, would preclude any precipitous actions by Hamas. So when October 7th came around, the Netanyahu government is faced with a whole new reality, and now they're adjusting to it. And this reality is 100% security, politically motivated. It's couched as a security reaction, but it's political. Benjamin Netanyahu was a politician already fighting for his political life prior to October 7th because of what he had done in terms of rewriting Israeli basic law regarding control of the judiciary. It was supposed to be an independent branch of government, and instead, under the new law, it would be subordinated to a politicized Israeli parliament, the Knesset. And the purpose of this wasn't to improve Israeli jurisprudence, but rather to prevent the prosecution of Benjamin Netanyahu on corruption charges. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of Israelis were already in the streets protesting against this man. The Israeli president had said that the situation was so dire that Israel could be looking at an actual civil war. And then comes October 7th. And so you have this already unpopular prime minister now presiding over the greatest security failure in the history of Israel. This is bigger than 1973 Yom Kippur War. This is a absolute failure on the part of the Netanyahu government, but also Israeli intelligence and the Israeli Defense Force themselves. And so the entire leadership of Israel is at risk of losing political viability, meaning that they should and could possibly be removed from power at any moment. The only reason why they're staying in power is because the Netanyahu government now has declared war, or as they have said, war was declared on Israel by Hamas. And if, I mean, if you're in for a dime, you might as well be in for a dollar. So if you're going to go to war with Hamas, now you articulate goals and objectives that reflect this war status. And you say that Israel is going to destroy not only the military aspects of Hamas, the organizational structures of Hamas, but politically. Hamas will be eliminated. Hamas will never again rule Gaza. And if you look at it from that standpoint, Israel has failed across the board. You know, when we take a look at the millions of people who are in the streets around in cities around the world protesting in support of Palestine, they're protesting in support of Hamas. They may not admit they are, but the reality is they wouldn't be there if it weren't for Hamas. They wouldn't be there if Hamas hadn't attacked Israel and created this this overreaction, or the opportunity for this overreaction. It's Israel that has done it to itself. Israel didn't need to invoke the Dahiya Doctrine, named after the West Beirut suburb, which in 2006, Israel flattened as part of a new principle of collective punishment, of that make sure that any civilian population linked to a political entity that is, you know, poses a security threat to Israel, that they will be punished collectively to put pressure on them to pressure their own political entity to stop doing what Israel objects to. It was done against the Lebanese to put pressure on Hezbollah. It failed miserably. And it's been done repeatedly against the Palestinians in Gaza to put pressure on Hamas. This is even prior to October 7th. And it's failed miserably. And it's failing now. This collective punishment that Israel has undertaken has turned the world against Israel. This is a victory for Hamas. You know, we need to also point out that the Netanyahu government was vociferously against a two-state solution, a Palestinian state, said there will not be one. They believe in Eretz Israel, greater Israel, or biblical Israel. That doesn't include any notion of a Palestinian statehood. And so right now, the entire world is talking about the absolute necessity of a two-state solution. Again, this wouldn't have happened without Hamas. Israel had taken thousands of Palestinians prisoner. They'd taken thousands more prisoner, treated them brutally, subjected them to torture, rape, murder. Nobody was talking about putting pressure on Israel to release these prisoners, these hostages held by Israel, until Hamas attacked on October 7th and took hostages of their own, which they use as a bargaining chip. This is a Hamas victory, not an Israeli victory. Israel is, you know, is suffering huge political consequences. More pressure is put on Netanyahu daily by the families of the remaining hostages to get their release. And Israel is not destroying Hamas. Hamas military is fighting the Israeli Defense Force to a standstill in many parts of Gaza. They're inflicting very significant casualties on Israel. And remember, Israel says that their victory is defined by the total destruction of Hamas. And if Israel doesn't achieve that, then Israel has by definition lost. And Israel right now is not achieving this. So the Netanyahu government has achieved nothing. They've made the situation even worse for Israel, and they've made it worse for them politically. You know, Netanyahu has a 4% approval rating. He had an emergency meeting of his war council the other night, and he concluded the business without holding the things he was putting forward up to vote. The point is, Israel's achieved none of its objectives, and it's not going to achieve these objectives. These objectives are unrealistic, and the Netanyahu government isn't doing anything for the legitimate security of Israel. They're doing everything for their own political survival, and I think their days are numbered. I think pressure is being put on them internally from domestic political opposition and externally from friends and allies, including the United States, who are saying that it's increasingly clear that the problem here is Benjamin Netanyahu, and that Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing coalition government have to step aside, have to get out of the way.
When it comes to the situation that Israel was in before October 7th, in terms of the relations with Arab states, with other countries surrounding Israel, how do you see it right now?
The fact is, Israel is in very many ways, because of its overwhelming support by the United States, the support that it gets from the United States, has become a de facto indispensable nation of the Middle East. And you combine that with the reality that, with very few exceptions, most nations in the Middle East are not pro-Palestinian. They're not supportive of the Palestinian Authority or a Palestinian state. And that Israel had exploited this antipathy amongst the Gulf Arab nations, for instance, amongst Israel's immediate neighbors toward the Palestinians for their own good, leveraging the concept of the possibility of a Palestinian state that could never be reach manifestation because of the definition. This is the Abrams Accord. What Israel has said about a two-state solution, it's unattainable, unachievable, unrealistic, but it's there on the table. And the Arab nations who claim to be supporting Palestine, but who secretly don't, say, well, Israel's made a good faith effort here. Now we'll normalize Israel relations with Israel so we can get on with the reaping the economic and geopolitical benefits of normalization. That all appears to be on hold, but nothing's fundamentally changed. The political reality of the situation is such that these nations have to take a stance that appears to be supportive of the Palestinian people, of a Palestinian state. But they are distancing themselves from Hamas, and they aren't cutting off relations with Israel, which tells me that if and when this conflict ends, and will end, that there is a real risk that these the nations that are lining up to support a Palestinian state today will slide back to their previous posture of either indifference or hostility towards Palestine. And this will be to the benefit of Israel. Now, the longer this conflict goes on, and the deeper the damage that Israel is doing to itself in terms of its how the world perceives it, could create a new political dynamic, a new political reality amongst these Arab states. And if that happens, then there will be a Palestinian state. There's no doubt in my mind. But if this conflict is brought to an end, and then the cause of a Palestinian state goes into endless negotiations by people who really don't have the best interests of Palestine in mind, we could find ourselves returning to square one, which then brings up Hamas, which is not going to quit until there is a Palestinian state. And I think that the failure of Israel to defeat Hamas empowers Hamas politically and gives them increased leverage to tell the Arab world, the Islamic world, that we will not go away, we will not quit, we will continue to resist, and that the best way to bring peace and stability to the region is to create a true Palestinian, independent Palestinian state, which includes Hamas as a political entity. You can't make Hamas disappear. If there were elections in the Palestinian, in the Gaza and West Bank today, I think Hamas would win overwhelmingly. The Palestinian Authority has no credibility, none, zero credibility. Hamas has all the credibility in the world because it's the only Arab organization that's fighting for the Palestinian people.
How do you see the possibility of Hezbollah getting more seriously involved in this battle? Is that possible, in your opinion?
Oh, of course it's possible. It's even likely, given what Hezbollah has done is it has maintained a extraordinarily high levels of pressure on Israel along the border between Israel and Lebanon. The purpose of this was to force Israel to divert resources from Gaza to Lebanon and to put strain, economic and political strain on Israel at a time when it was supposed to be singularly focused on resolving the Gaza crisis. Up to 70,000 Israelis have been evacuated from northern Israel. They have to be housed, cared for at enormous economic cost to Israel. Whatever economic activity took place in the north has come to a halt. So that's an unsustainable reality that Israel can't just allow to occur. And Hezbollah keeps ratcheting up the pressure. Israel right now has confronted Benny Gantz, the minister of war, has come out and said that Israel has no choice but to turn its attention to Lebanon to compel Hezbollah to withdraw from the border. This is suicidal. Lebanon is as prepared for whatever Israel is going to do as Hamas was prepared for Israel. And Hezbollah is an organization that has far more military capacity than Hamas. It will be fatal for Israel to expand this conflict. And I think that's why it might not happen, is that the Israelis know that if they engage decisively with Hezbollah, they will suffer a decisive defeat. And that could be very problematic, not only for the Netanyahu government, but for anybody who's joined his coalition, his wartime coalition, like Benny Gantz and others. So it's a very dangerous situation, one where there is an absolute threat of an expansion of this conflict to draw in Hezbollah, but also one that the consequences of such expansion are so dire that it might be difficult for Israel to act on it, which is what Hezbollah is betting on, that Israel will make a decision to seek a ceasefire before they make a decision to escalate. Time will tell.
One of the countries that is so important is Saudi Arabia. How do you see their policy in Gaza? Are they looking for some sort of sanity, some sort of solution for Gaza?
Well, their official position and what their real position is might be two different things. Their official position is that they support Palestine, they support the Palestinian people, they support a two-state solution, and therefore they are opposed to the ongoing Israeli actions. Their unofficial position is they were ready to normalize relations with Israel to offset the axis of resistance, Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, Iran, the Houthi, pro-Shia militias in Iraq. Yes, because of China, Saudi Arabia and Iran had normalized relations. But that doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia is going to roll over and play dead. It was not a Saudi surrender. And Saudi Arabia was very interested in ensuring that it maintained a dominant geopolitical position vis-a-vis the Middle East. And they were looking to do that by normalizing relations with Israel and creating the conditions where Israel would be able to insert itself into the Persian Gulf region in a way that helped offset, Iran's growing stature in these nations that are linked to the axis of resistance. So the Saudis are in a very, they're stuck between the horns of a dilemma right now. They can't continue to carry out a policy which, by any stretch of the imagination, is pro-Israeli in nature, normalizing relations, bringing Israel into the Gulf region to offset Iranian influence. And they can't ignore the new reality generated by Hamas's military operation on October 7th and what's transpired since then, by ignoring a Palestinian two-state solution. So I think what Saudi Arabia is doing is buying time, saying all the right things, hosting a conference, but doing nothing, and waiting to see where the chips finally fall before they would decisively commit. Remember, Saudi Arabia's number one purpose for doing anything is to benefit Saudi Arabia. So they're not going to be looking for something that brings about, in and of its own right, a regional peace and security. They're going to be looking for something that benefits Saudi Arabia. It may be something that benefits regional peace and security, but it may be something different. Saudi Arabia has a vision. I think they call it Vision 2030, about a new Saudi Arabia, new economic realities, new social political realities. And that's the direction that MBS is taking Saudi Arabia. And they cannot support anything that that threatens that vision, because that vision is about a redefining of Saudi Arabia. It's what its economy looks like, what its geopolitical posture looks like. And that's going to require a lot of money to make happen. And that money won't be there if Saudi Arabia does anything that causes a disruption to, its oil-based economy, or fundamentally changes the balance of power in the Middle East, so that Saudi Arabia is compelled to take an action one way or the other. So this is a very, very dangerous situation. And, one can always hope that the Saudis find a way to navigate their way through these troubled waters. I think it's important to point out that Israel wasn't the only nation taken surprise by Hamas's attack on October 7th. Saudi Arabia was taken by surprise, and Iran was taken by surprise. Prior to October 7th, Iran and Saudi Arabia were working together to create regional stability based upon, emphasizing diplomacy over military confrontation. They had exchanged ambassadors, and they were moving forward in a very coherent fashion to achieve, their collective desire for regional stability. After October 7th, both Saudi Arabia and Iran are struggling to catch up to the reality of what happened. Iran certainly doesn't want a larger regional war. Iran doesn't want to be drawn into the fighting. And Saudi Arabia doesn't want that either. Remember when Saudi Arabia hosted the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic States to a conference, an emergency conference on Gaza? Iran participated. The Iranian president has flown to Riyadh and has met with MBS and other Saudi officials to talk about the Gaza situation. So I think what we're seeing here is that Iran and Saudi Arabia are making sure that whatever transpires vis-a-vis Israel and Hamas, that their relations will remain on track in terms of, positive interaction, conflict avoidance, peacemaking, and joint economic prosperity. So I think you're going to see the Iranians and the Saudis working together to keep this conflict contained to Gaza and Gaza alone. It's a very difficult challenge. Look at the Houthi. They've basically expanded the entire Red Sea into a combat zone. and the support that Iran provides to the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, that Iran provides to Hezbollah, this is real. But I don't think neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia are going to lose strategic focus. And the strategic focus right now is determined more by the peacemaking of China in bringing about a rapprochement between these two countries than how Iran and Saudi Arabia are reacting to what Israel's doing in Gaza.
When this conflict ends, is the Netanyahu administration capable of rebuilding their relations with these Arab nations, Turkey? Is that possible for the Netanyahu administration, or do we have to have a new administration in Israel who's capable of doing such a thing?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the all-time great political survivors. And people in Israel have been trying to get him out of office for some time now, and yet he somehow manages to land on his feet. So you never want to underestimate Benjamin Netanyahu and his his ability to control Israeli politics in a way that keeps him in power. Having said that, though, his support rate is at 4%. That's not sustainable. That's not viable. I believe that there will be a change of government in Israel. I believe it'll be sooner rather than later, given the enormous negative consequences that have accrued since, the Hamas attack on October 7th. Netanyahu is the problem. He's the man who is asleep at the wheel, and you can't trust him to do the right thing for Israel, because what he's trying to do is the right thing for keeping Netanyahu in power, and those two goals and objectives may not coincide. So I don't think that we're going to see a situation where this conflict ends and then Netanyahu steps aside. I think we're going to see a situation where Netanyahu is compelled to step aside and then this conflict ends, and then we find out if the world is capable of negotiating good faith about, the future demarcation between Arabs and Israelis, things of that nature.